We've heard quite a bit about eosinophilia over the last couple of days, so there will be some revision involved here. So the definition, I see it's slightly different from the one Baz gave you. He said less than 0.5, but in London we use 0.4, but it's not a big difference. So it is commonly in our practice associated with helminth infection, may also be associated, as he pointed out, with fungal infections, but we don't see nearly so many of them in our practice in London. Most of our patients have been in the tropics rather than in North America. It is usually associated with migration of the worms, so we will have a look at worms in a moment. Those that reside purely in the gut and don't have a migratory phase don't usually cause an eosinophilia. And, of course, not everyone with a helminth infection will have a raised eosinophil count. So there are many worms which affect humans. There are the tapeworms, the cestodes, which Taenia saginata, the beef tapeworm, lives in the human gut, does not usually cause an eosinophilia, but Taenia solium, the pig tapeworm, can cause tissue lesions and is associated with eosinophilia in many cases. And then hydatidcyst, echinococcus, we'll talk a little bit about if the cyst leaks, that will give rise to an eosinophilia. We've discussed the schistosomes yesterday. There are other flukes which we will talk about in a moment. Then there are the tissue nematodes which we discussed yesterday, Onchocerca and lymphatic filariasis and lower, which live in the tissues and usually cause eosinophilia. And then this one, Mansonella perstans, which is common in Central and East Africa, but which actually doesn't cause any symptoms at all. And then we have the gut nematodes, so the pinworm and whipworm, which reside purely in the gut, do not cause an eosinophilia. The others, which have a migratory phase, may do so. So the common ones we find associated with eosinophilia are Strongyloides, which we discussed a bit yesterday, and I will say more about today. Schistosomiasis, we discussed yesterday, along with filariasis and Onchocerca. And then these gut, so Ascaris, Cysticercus, hookworm, hydatid, and fasciola may cause eosinophilia, and we will talk a little bit more about a couple of them. So what investigations may be useful if you see a returning traveler with eosinophilia? Well, stool microscopy to look for eggs or parasites, a terminal urine we discussed for Schistosoma hematobium, day and night bloods for the filarial worms, skin snips for onco, we discussed all this yesterday, and serology. Of course, not everyone with an eosinophilia has an infectious cause. People with allergies commonly have a raised eosinophil count or drug reactions. And then there are some other conditions, vasculitis, various skin disorders, and malignancies which can give rise to an eosinophilia. So I'm going to present three cases of eosinophilia that we've seen at the Hospital for Tropical Diseases in London in recent years. So the first was a 31-year-old woman from New Zealand who had had an adventure holiday in the jungle in Venezuela. She came back on the 18th of January. She had been well during her adventure holiday, apart from 3 days of acute watery diarrhea. She'd not had any fever, any cough or chest symptoms, and she had a second episode of diarrhea 5 days later, and a third episode after returning from Venezuela brought her to see us a month after she got back. She had by that stage lost a little bit of weight. She had some abdominal and epigastric pain. she was having loose stools up to 7 times a day. She had a history of mild asthma but no allergies. She had been taking the oral contraceptive pill but had stopped 1 month previously. On examination, there was some upper abdominal tenderness but nothing else to find. No ovocysts or parasites were found in a stool sample. She was treated empirically for giardiasis with tinidazole. She didn't get better. She came back a couple of weeks later, still having diarrhea and abdominal discomfort. So at that stage, she had a sigmoidoscopy and a rectal biopsy, which showed prominent eosinophils, but no amoebae and no evidence of inflammation. Stool microscopy again was negative, but she had a leukocytosis and a very high eosinophil count of more than 7. She was treated empirically with ciprofloxacin for 5 days. So what investigations would you do now? Let's ask the people in the front row. So she has an eosinophil count of more than 7, and she's had 2 negative stool microscopies. She's been in Venezuela. Well, unfortunately, some of our registrars, present company excluded, of course, they tend to request everything on the form. So these are the tests that were requested. They ticked every box on the form. Now, not all of these things cause eosinophilia, so amoebiasis does not cause eosinophilia. But anyway, it was negative, and so was everything else. So serology for all those things, day and night bloods, looking for lymphatic filariasis, everything was negative. So she came back. This is now a month after she first saw us and 2 months after she got back from Venezuela. No improvement. Again, stool microscopy and culture were negative. What would you do now? Well, we decided to treat her empirically for worms. So she was given ivermectin, single dose. And ivermectin is quite a good broad-spectrum anti-helminthic. It's the treatment of choice for strongyloides. You remember we spoke of onchocerciasis yesterday, where it will kill the microfilaria, though not the adult worms. And it's highly effective against Ascaris and Trichuris, 2 gut nematodes that are common, and also effective treatment for scabies. It's less effective against hookworm. So she came back a week later. No better. So we're not doing well here. She's been seeing us now for over a month and we've not managed to cure her. Her eosinophil count has gone up. It's now 12 or almost 13. But we have at last made a diagnosis. So she had hookworm over in her stool sample. So we think what this lady had been suffering from was the migratory phase of the hookworm as it migrates through the lungs before it reaches the gut and matures and starts laying eggs. So we treated her with albendazole. Remember, I told you ivermectin is not so effective against hookworm. And a week later, her eosinophil count was almost back to normal and her symptoms had all resolved. So could we have done better with this patient? We saw her for almost 6 weeks before we were able to give her the correct treatment. We did well to keep on sending the stool samples because it can take weeks for the hookworm to mature and start laying eggs. Could we have relieved her symptoms sooner? Perhaps we should have given empirical antihelminthic treatment sooner, and perhaps we should have given albendazole rather than ivermectin, which has a broader spectrum and covers hookworm better. So that was one case. Second case, a young English woman aged 28 who had been working in Uganda as a nurse for 18 months. in northern Uganda and in the capital of Kampala. She had been there with her husband. She became pregnant while she was there. She came back to the UK in May 2008 and had twins delivered in July by cesarean section and came to see us in October, so that is now 4 or 5 months after returning from Uganda. She had had a wound infection at the site of her cesarean section. She'd had fever and rigors for 3 weeks after that, treated with broad-spectrum antibiotics. That was in July. In early September, she developed fever and rigors again. No cause for that was found. It resolved after 5 days. Came to see in mid-September, developed a fever again with some respiratory symptoms and occasional loose stools. On examination, she appeared well. She was breastfeeding her twins. She had no fever. She had a tachycardia. Her chest was clear and nothing else to find. She was slightly anemic and she had an eosinophilia and a slightly raised CRP. Alkaline phosphatase was slightly raised, liver function tests otherwise normal. A malaria film was negative. Stool, we found stool on microscopy, blastocystis hominis, which we believe is a harmless commensal and does not cause eosinophilia. We requested serology. Schistosomiasis, she had been in Uganda, was negative. Strongyloides, a common cause of eosinophilia we discussed briefly yesterday, was negative. And serology for filaria was negative, so we think she did not have lymphatic filariasis or Mansonella perstans, which is common in Uganda, or onchocerciasis. And her chest x-ray was normal. Follow-up, a few weeks later, she's having occasional night sweats. She is not coughing so much, but she has developed a new symptom of pain below the ribs on the right for the past 2 days, worse on deep inspiration. On examination, she was afebrile. She appeared well, but there was tenderness in the right upper quadrant. The liver was not palpable, but there was a suspicion it was enlarged because there was an increased area of dullness to percussion. Her eosinophil count has gone up. Her ESR is now 131, her hemoglobin has fallen slightly, alkaline phosphatase remains raised. We sent another stool sample, again, no parasites were found. We requested an abdominal ultrasound. We were concerned she may have an amoebic liver abscess because of, as we discussed earlier, hepatic enlargement and tenderness, though she had no fever and no leukocytosis. And as we've mentioned, eosinophilia is not seen in amoebiasis, but we requested an abdominal ultrasound. We treated her empirically with albendazole for 3 days. We saw her again 2 weeks later. She developed a bit of a rash and some edema of the legs. She now had right upper quadrant pain and pain in the right shoulder, suggesting diaphragmatic irritation. She was afebrile, the chest was clear, there was now a clearly enlarged liver, and her spleen tip was palpable. And here is the ultrasound. What do you think? Is it normal? No. So it's clearly abnormal. There is an area of I'm sure you can all see this, there is an area of reduced density here. So what is going on here? Could this be an amoebic liver abscess? This was our concern, but she had no fever, no leukocytosis. So we requested serology for amoebiasis. It was negative. We again ticked a lot of the boxes on the serology request form. Her schisto is now borderline positive, having been negative. But here was the diagnosis. So this lady had a liver fluke, fasciola hepatica, with strongly positive serology. So we called her back. Eosinophil count is still raised. Her inflammatory markers are up. ALP FOS is raised. So we treated her initially with praziquantel because at this stage we had the schistoserology back but not the fasciola. So we treated her for schistosomiasis and she got better. So her right upper quadrant pain had gone and no more pain in the shoulder. She again had a rash on her legs with some edema, but that had resolved. Her liver has gone down. There's no tenderness. She still has a spleen tip. We now got the result of the fasciola serology. We treated her with triclobendazole, which is the treatment of choice. And she had a CT, and you can see, I think, that this looks quite significantly abnormal. She came back in January. She was well with no symptoms. She hadn't taken the triclobendazole because she was breastfeeding and thought it might be harmful to the babies. But she had got better. Her symptoms had resolved. Her eosinophil count had fallen. Her inflammatory markers had gone down. Her liver function tests were now normal, but her serology remained positive. So this appeared to have resolved, possibly as a result of the praziquantel, or possibly had resolved of its own accord. Nevertheless, we encouraged her to take her triclobendazole once she had stopped breastfeeding. Her eosinophil count by now was normal and the serology was going down in Tita. And her scan was returning to normal. So she had suffered from a liver fluke. This is a parasite of sheep. The life cycle involves a snail intermediate host, and humans are infected by eating vegetation contaminated with larvae. And this does occasionally occur in the UK in areas where there are a lot of sheep, usually in people eating watercress. And we had an outbreak in London among the Somali population who chew this leaf, which has stimulatory properties. They chew it. It's imported from Somalia and Kenya, and in some cases contaminated with Metasercariae of fasciola. So many people are at risk. Many people are infected. Most of them probably have no symptoms. In this case, the acute stage where the worm is migrating through the liver, as in this case, can cause symptoms such as this patient had. The worm then matures, and it may live in the common bile duct and may give rise to cholangitis, but in most cases causes no symptoms. So a very common infection, commonly asymptomatic, but an occasional cause of eosinophilia and hepatic symptoms. Treatment of choice is triclobendazole. This is what the vets use to treat sheep. And it appears to be very effective, though there is some evidence now of resistance in sheep. And my final case, I'm going to talk about Strongyloides. Remember, we discussed it yesterday. This can replicate in the human host. We discussed a case yesterday who had had it for 50 years. So it can hang around for a very long time. It is the commonest cause of eosinophilia among our patients in London. We see many people from the Indian subcontinent living in London who are found on a routine blood test to have an eosinophilia and are referred to us for investigation. They nearly all have Strongyloides. So it is a very common cause of eosinophilia. It lives in the small intestine. It's a small worm. It gets into the body through the skin, migrates through the lungs, and the adults live in the small bowel. They may cause a malabsorption syndrome in the case of a very heavy infection, but usually asymptomatic. But the point is that autoinfection occurs which is how they can persist for 50 years or longer. And because there is a phase where they pass through the tissues, it usually causes an eosinophilia. And it is a very important parasite to diagnose because it can cause very severe complications, so-called hyperinfection syndrome in people who are immunocompromised for any reason. And at that stage, the eosinophils may not be raised. So I'm just going to present one case we saw a couple of years ago at the HTD. We discussed this yesterday, the transient rash associated with strongyloides. But so this was a West Indian man, aged 39 years, born in Grenada in the West Indies, moved to the UK at the age of 12 years, had lived in the UK since then. And he presented to hospital with right upper quadrant and epigastric pain for 2 months. On examination, he had an epigastric mass. Ultrasound showed multiple loops of small bowel with thickened walls and thickened overlying omentum. CT scan, a large mass arising from the pancreas involving the bowel and mesentery with mediastinal lymph nodes, pleural effusion, a pelvic mass in front of the bladder and ascites, and an ascitic tap showed a high-grade T-cell lymphoma. He was HTLV-1 positive. This is a retrovirus that is associated with T-cell lymphoma. He was HIV negative. He was started on chemotherapy. He developed diarrhea on the chemotherapy, but his ascites and pleural effusion started to resolve. He was given further courses of chemotherapy, and 2 months into his chemotherapy became unwell with headache, nausea, and vomiting. The headache was severe. He had a lumbar puncture, which showed a high white count, mostly polymorphs, and he was started on treatment with cefotaxime. He developed a paralytic ileus. He had an oral gastroduodenoscopy, which showed severe duodenal erosions, nodular appearance. The endoscopist thought this looked like recurrent lymphoma. He took some biopsies. He had a CT, which showed a probable perforation and necrotic mass around the duodenum, and a repeat gastroduodenoscopy, widespread abnormal gastric and duodenal mucosa, query due to recurrence of the lymphoma. However, the biopsy came back showing strongyloides and no evidence of lymphoma. So the lymphoma had been treated, but he had developed hyperinfection syndrome due to his undiagnosed and untreated strongyloides. He had a laparotomy. There was dilated small bowel, grossly thickened and inflamed, huge necrotic glands around the duodenal jejunal flexure. There was no perforation or abscess. He was started on a course of ivermectin. He developed an ileus. Strongyloides were found in stool, urine, and sputum, so he had a disseminated strongyloidiasis with a diffuse pneumonitis. He was started on daily subcutaneous ivermectin, but he died. So here was a patient who died not of his lymphoma, but of his strongyloides. And if this had been diagnosed before starting his chemotherapy and he had been treated with 2 doses of ivermectin, he would still be alive. So strongyloides hyperinfection is seen in people who may have had a chronic infection for many years with no symptoms. Interestingly, it's not associated with HIV, though there is an association with HTLV-1, that other retrovirus that this man was infected with. The larvae in hyperinfection syndrome penetrate the bowel wall. They cause gram-negative sepsis, often with meningitis, as he had, and there is a high mortality. So if you forget everything else I've said over the last 2 days, please remember Strongyloides, because it's very common. It's a lifelong infection, usually causes no symptoms, but usually causes an eosinophilia, and that's how you can pick it up. It's easy to diagnose with stool microscopy or serology, and it's easy to treat. But as in the case I just described, if you forget about it and don't treat it, then it may be fatal. So that's my final message. Thank you for listening.